Welcome to Grading the Nutmeg, the podcast of Connecticut history and the 2023 winner of an Award of Merit for Excellence from the Connecticut League of History Organizations. Brought to you by Connecticut Explored, the magazine of Connecticut history. I'm Mary Donahue. You helped us achieve over 30,000 downloads in 2023. Want to help us do even better in 2024? You can help us by subscribing to the podcast, writing a review, and leaving us a comment on our social media pages. Oh, and tell your friends. In this episode, we celebrate and commemorate National Bariguaneers Day coming up on April 13th. It recognizes the bravery, service, and sacrifice of the 65th Infantry Regiment, a U.S. Army unit that consisted mostly of soldiers from Puerto Rico and was the only segregated Latino unit in the United States Army. But the honor and fidelity of the men of the 65th came into question in 1952 during the Korean War, when 91 regiment members were arrested and tried for desertion and disobeying orders. How could this happen to such a distinguished and decorated unit of the Army? My guest today is accomplished Connecticut author of young adult literature, Talia Akins Nunez. In her book, Men of the 65th, The Bariguaneers of the Korean War, she guides us through the history of the 65th beginning in 1899. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, after I started reading your new book, I was really pleased to see that the 65th Regiment was featured in a recent episode of the PBS series Finding Your Roots. Anthony Ramos, who was one of the young stars of Hamilton, he discovered that his grandfather was in Puerto Rico's 65th Regiment, and he didn't know that before. Before we dive into that regiment's history, maybe you can explain how the regiment got its name.
Sure. So as the men were sailing to a destination they didn't know, this was going to the Korean War, they knew they wanted to have a battle name like every other unit in the military. And so during one of their meetings, they had a discussion about, okay, what's our battle name going to be? So they wanted to have the essence of who they were and to also show their, you know, military fighting spirit. And so they chose the name Borinquenir. And Borinquen is actually the original name for the island of Puerto Rico that the people that lived there before, the Taino natives, had for the island. And then the last part is based off of the Spanish pirates, the Buccaneers. So that's how they came up with the Borinquenirs.
Well, that sounds fierce to me. I would like to be named after a pirate group, too. So this regiment is unique for a lot of different reasons, but how does it get its start?
So after the Spanish-American War, Puerto Rico became a territory of the United States. And then in 1899, the unit was established by the government. And at that time, Puerto Ricans were not American citizens. So to be a part of this unit, they had to take, you know, American citizenship tests, participate in what was then just the 65th Infantry Regiment. So the unit was established in 1899, but then as in the Jones Seyfarth Act, Puerto Ricans were given citizenship. However, the caveat for that was that they are allowed to be drafted. They would be part of any draft if the United States went to war. And that has stood since.
So I was reading in the book, which I just enjoyed so much, and this paragraph caught my attention about the overall background for the unit. You say, the U.S. military still enforced segregation during World War II by separating non-white soldiers into their own units commanded by white officers. And you say, during an interview years later, retired Staff Sergeant Gabriel Santo Rivera remembered his surprise from when he was being asked during basic training to remove his shirt and show his skin. He says, that's how they determined to which unit the Black Puerto Ricans and the white Puerto Ricans would go. Well, I was surprised because we, Puerto Ricans, have always interacted with one another just the same. I was kind of embarrassed by it. That's when I learned that there was racism in the Army, unquote. So they were in an interesting situation in a segregated unit. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So what he was referencing was a procedure they would do with the soldiers. So after they did whatever formations or exercises they did, they'd have to line up, take their shirts off. And then if they were darker than a paper bag, there'd be a paper bag put against their back. So if they were darker than that paper bag, they'd go to one of the black units. If they were lighter than the paper bag, then they'd stay with the 65th. And so this really surprised a lot of the men that were a part of the unit because of this, the natural culture of Puerto Rico, and that those types of practices continued for some time until there was desegregation in the military.
So the Korean War is not one that we've really covered very often here in the podcast, if ever. And it's sometimes referred to as the Forgotten War. How did it start and how did the United States become involved?
So on the heels of World War II, when they were trying to find peaceful ways for everyone to coexist, that's the best way I can summarize it without going into too much detail, they created a line that went across Korea. And this is called the 38th parallel. It's an arbitrary line. And that separated North Korea from South Korea. North Korea was going to be controlled by the Soviets and communist government. And South Korea was to be essentially controlled or supported by the United States government. And both Soviets and the United States helped implement government systems for their respective areas. However, after World War II, the North Koreans, for various reasons, I go into a couple of them in the book, proceeded to invade South Korea. And they were under the impression with Stalin and the government of North Korea that the United States initially was not going to support South Korea. However, as the North Koreans progressed down the peninsula and captured all of Korea, the United States got involved and proceeded to push them back above the 38th parallel. And at that point, around then, that's when the Borinqueneers got involved.
So the Borinqueneers are a regiment based in Puerto Rico. They've seen action since 1899. They've been in the Panama Canal Zone, for example. They've been other places. But this is really a big change where they are sent overseas to Korea. What kind of conditions and battles and even terrain did they face in Korea?
Absolutely everything you can think of. They faced hot temperatures similar to their climate in Puerto Rico, and they also faced frigid temperatures like those in the mountains of North Korea. They experienced flooding and torrential rains that a lot of Korea experiences during certain times of year. And they experienced very dry, arid conditions of South Korea. So they had to fight in all types of conditions. And one of the things that I always, highlight is that they had to fight. They sailed from Puerto Rico with their summer clothes, their summer uniforms. And as they progressed up the peninsula into North Korea, the temperatures dipped to the negatives. And they still had those summer uniforms on. So they had to create heat gadgets and layering processes and things like that, so that, they wouldn't have frostbite, even though there are several soldiers that did experience frostbite, but to keep their fingers working for the equipment and their feet warm so that they could walk.
How well trained and prepared were they to be sent overseas?
So after World War II, the military realized that there was a lot of what they call battle fatigue, and they lost a lot of soldiers, and there weren't as many men available to go to Korea. Right before Korea broke out, the 65th participated in a military exercise. It's called Operation Port Rex. Port Rex is because it took place in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico exercise Port Rex. And during this exercise, they were going to be pitted against some of the most decorated men in the military, from the Air Force, from the Army, from different parts of the military, to essentially keep the island. So to keep with the people, with the U.S. military, the ones from World War II were called the Liberators. And then they were in the exercise called the aggressors. So the aggressors had to try to keep the liberators from taking over the tiny island of Vieques, because Vieques is where they did a lot of military exercises. And so when they were very successful in that exercise, and because the U.S. military really had depleted their soldiers that were available, when the Korean War came out, they were given their chance to fight in combat, as opposed to having those support roles that they were typically relegated to in previous wars, like World War I and World War II.
I know, that's an amazing shift, because as you say in the book, there were so many white officers who just didn't expect that soldiers of color could be very capable, fierce soldiers in military action. And so they would get those support services where you're doing supplies, or you're doing moving things, or you're doing kitchen duty, even, you know, those sorts of things. So this is a big shift for them to really be in action in a just grueling war where land is just fought over inch by inch in Korea. What kind of role do you think that language played in the regiment's work and in their success?
So when they first sailed in 1950 to Korea, the leadership made a distinct effort to have what are called non-commissioned officers, NCOs. And those officers, a lot of them were in World War II and were experienced in the military and bilingual. And so they were that link between the enlisted men, who were mostly or primarily Spanish speaking, and the continental officers, who were those white officers that typically went to like West Point, that led the unit. So they had coordinated meetings to make sure that there was communication between the different levels. They made specific efforts to ensure that communication was not a barrier, but a strength. So frequently during the night when the North Koreans would attack, they would speak to each other in Spanish so that, you know, the opposition had no clue what they were saying. So they used it as a way to maneuver in battle, as well as, like I said, those NCOs to make sure that there was always communication amongst the different levels.
I know at one point there is an officer that prohibits the use of Spanish or speaking Spanish by the troops. How did that play out?
So actually, there's the military leader that a lot of people refer to as like one of the best leader of the men of the 65th, and that is Colonel Harris. And so when he was sent to the unit, I think that was late 49, if I'm not mistaken, he removed the prohibition of speaking Spanish to each other. And so, and again, he saw it as a strength. He saw it as a tool or something they have in their back pocket that maybe other soldiers didn't. And so anytime he saw those types of things that could be used to their benefit, he would employ them. And so men that served under Harris really enjoyed their military, or as much as you can enjoy a military experience in war, but they were a very well-trained, well-led group.
I would think you'd feel so much more seen and respected if your language is acknowledged and you're able to use it. And like I said, to see it as a strength is the right way to go. And certainly, I'm sure, help them.
That's part of the reason in the war, he saw the opportunity to give the men a little something that would remind them of home and comfort them. So he changed their rations to rice and beans. It's not, of course, going to be, you know, their moms or their grandmas or, you know, their rice and beans, but at least with a little something to acknowledge their culture and to try to make them feel a bit more supported in the war.
We'll be back in a minute with my guest.
Educators, history lovers, and people like you, who all share our commitment to telling Connecticut's stories, are at the heart of each Connecticut Explored magazine issue. Friends of Connecticut Explored provide important support for the continued publication of the magazine and make our educational initiatives possible, from discounted subscriptions for teachers and students to the development of social studies resources for K-12 students. With your help, we can continue connecting the public to our state's history through accessible, engaging, and diverse storytelling for generations to come, visit ctexplored.org and click Friends of Connecticut Explored under the Donate tab to make your tax-deductible gift today. We thank you for your generous support.
Praised as an ambitious and insightful book, African American Connecticut Explored is the first collection to delve into the African American experience in Connecticut from the earliest years of the state's colonization into the 20th century. Celebrating its 10th year of publication, this award-winning book is used in schools across the state and prominently features the voices of Connecticut's African Americans through its 50 essays. Explore more about the Black governors of Connecticut, prominent Black abolitionists, the 29th Regiment of Colored Volunteers in the Civil War, and even baseball great Jackie Robinson by purchasing your copy. Published by Wesleyan University Press, this book represents the collaborative effort of Connecticut Explored and the Amistad Center for Art and Culture, with support from the State Historic Preservation Office and Connecticut's Freedom Trail. Copies are available at Wesleyan University Press.
I know that the regiment as a whole, they had such a strong sense of patriotism, which I really admire because they had so many levels of discrimination that they did face, but they were very patriotic and they were considered a really fierce unit. And there are several quotes from military historians in your book about that. But Korea, as I said, was just brutal. And at one point, they're in a battle, I think in 1952, that every aspect of it falls apart. And then there's a wave of court-martials. This is a significant story. Can you tell us that?
So in 1952, so this is the point when, you know, there were peace talks that were happening. So really, on the United States side, the rule was kind of maintain. Don't try to advance too much. Just maintain the line, because they were hopeful that they could end this conflict. And so they were at the 38th parallel, and they had their positions at the 38th parallel. And the military had one hill that was a bit beyond that main line of resistance, MLR. The thing about this hill, there are a few characteristics. It's called Hill 391. And after this after what happened there, it's referred to as Jackson Heights. That hill was a rock. It wasn't, so the military usually, to fortify their positions, they do something called digging in. So they dig into the ground to create areas so that they're covered, so that they can defend themselves against attacks. So this hill since it was a rock, you couldn't dig in. And on top of it, like I said, it was in front of the main line of resistance. So one of the distinct advantages the United States had in the Korean War was air support. And so this hill, because it was so far in front, it was in front of the MLR, couldn't be supported by air. So for example, if they needed more ammunition, if they needed more rations for food, if whatever they needed, it wasn't easily brought to them. And because of those dynamics, meaning they can't dig in, so they weren't able to hide, they were essentially, I think in the book I call them sitting ducks, because the enemy can essentially just fire away at them. And so that's what they did. And they fired and they fired and they fired. They couldn't keep the hill. And so eventually they retreat. And then they're ordered to go back. And there were men that refused at that point. That also was after they experienced another defeat right before that, which is a hill called Kelly Hill. And so you had these two traumatic experiences back to back, and that caused some men to refuse to fight. And so then they were brought into the largest court-martial of the Korean War for that. So the 65th made up all the soldiers of that court martial. I should also note about this hill. This hill was really a very hard hill to maintain. So at another point during the war, when another unit, which was a white unit, couldn't maintain that hill, and they also retreated, they weren't court martialed for refusing to go back. So it shows just those discrepancies in the military at that time that the men of the 65th had to deal with.
So there's over 90 initial court-martials, I believe. And the men start to write home about this, and it gets into the newspaper. How does that public pressure affect the situation?
So initially, they tried to downplay the number. They initially said there were fewer, and eventually the New York Times reported, or actually the military gave the appropriate number, because the New York Times really kept digging, and they were getting these letters that people were sending from Puerto Rico. And so once that pressure between, misreporting the numbers and not giving all of the details of the court martials, the military decided to re-review what happened. And eventually, years later, all the men were exonerated. But what it also just showed for the unit as a whole was the military also had politically going on integration in the military. And so there was also pressure about that as well. And so the military decided, okay, we're integrating, we're moving forward, and they exonerated the men.
If you're an individual soldier, you must have, kind of dire consequences to being court-martialed. Do you lose all your benefits?
Yes. Yes, you. When they were convicted, they lost all of their benefits. So a lot of them, that was money for their families back home. They lost their pay. They lost everything. And so, while the military did exonerate them a few years later, they had to go those few years without those things, even though they served their country and were honorable in their service. They had to not rely on this benefit that was an earned benefit.
It certainly was earned, because, as I said, it's just, this one is such a brutal war. I was reading on a military website that the Army really had to quickly pardon them, and they later blamed incompetent Army leadership, poor military tactics, racism, and really organizational prejudice for all those events that landed these people in the brig. And as you said, there were comparable white units that face the same conditions and made the same decision not to go forward into a conflict or covering a piece of ground like that, that did not have that court martial hanging over them and have that go forward. So it just seemed unfortunate that that happened when it did. And I'm sure it really demoralized Puerto Ricans in terms of their patriotism and their sense of pride in themselves and in this regiment. Now, I was also reading that it looks like 61,000 Puerto Ricans served in the American Army. 48% of them were recruited on the island. And so that's a large number to go directly from Puerto Rico. That was in the Army's historic review on the 65th court-martial. They endured more than 700 dead and more than 2,000 wounded. So Puerto Rico really suffered one casualty for every 660 inhabitants, more than double the rate for the continental U.S. I just think that is phenomenal.
Yeah, there was really a pride in Puerto Rico when you serve in the military. And the other thing that I think a lot of people, I don't know if we can understand, because it's a small island and it's an island. So a lot of these folks that were going there were neighbors, cousins, siblings. And so when they lost someone, it was someone potentially that was close to them. And so that loss, while it's hard for anybody in the military to lose a fellow soldier, it just had that extra bit of personal relationship.
Eventually, they are awarded, way past the date they should have been, the Congressional Medal of Honor, and it was awarded by President Barack Obama. Could you read his quote from the back of the book?
Sure. In World War I, they defended the homeland and patrolled the Panama Canal Zone. In World War II, they fought in Europe. In Korea, they fought in mud and snow. They are the 65th Infantry Regiment, U.S. Army.
That is so well deserved. Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in this topic?
So many, many years ago, my husband, we always go to family events, especially for big holidays. So one Easter many, many years ago, we were going to his family's house, and his grandparents were there. And his grandfather showed me a medal he earned in the war, in the Korean War. And so I, you know, of course asked, I said, oh, I didn't know you served. What, you know, what unit were you with? And he said, the fierce Orangineers. And I said, who are they? And I felt, you know, ashamed because, you know, I've gone to, you know, high school, college, graduate school, and I did not know about this unit. Then he told me some of the history of this unit. And I did what every person generally does. I Googled after we finished having Easter dinner, and I found some history on them. And so I, of course, wanted to check for something about them for my kids, who I wanted to know about what their great-grandfather did in history. And I couldn't find a book. And so that was a point that my husband said. He was like, well, I guess you have to write one then. And so I did.
You know, I learned so much from this book, and I really highly recommend it. But I know you wrote it so that it could be really enjoyed by a young adult audience. And I think that is so important. I think you said you commissioned the art that's on the cover. Can you tell me about that?
So I wanted to make sure that the soldiers reflected the men, but I also wanted to give little tidbits about kind of what you will see in the story. So for example, after the men had that devastating loss at Kelly Hill, that was before the Jackson Heights incident, they were given new commanders because the military thought that they lacked leadership. And the new commanders said that the unit had lost its order and orderliness and ordered that the men were to shave all of their facial hair until they could show their manhood. And so that really hit a lot of the men hard. But in the picture, what I wanted to make sure like that was shown was these men were fierce from the whole time that they served there. Facial hair, no facial, like they were always good, fierce fighting soldiers. And so I wanted to make sure that the cover showed that in any part of the war, this picture, or in any part of the Korean War, this picture would apply.
There are so many great black and white photographs in the book. And I want to encourage any of our listeners who had family that have served or have any photos, we would love to see them. So there's a Grading the Nutmeg Facebook page. We would love to see them posted. That would be fabulous. And I also want to let our listeners know that there's a wonderful, very well-designed monument to the Borinqueneers in New Britain at the intersection of Beaver and Farmington Streets. It's just so well worth a stop to visit. Every detail of it includes symbolism from the name to the way it looks like a triumphal arch, but it's based on El Moro in Puerto Rico. It uses pavers that remind us of Puerto Rico. And then it's got the official insignia in those pavers. So it's just, every detail of it really tells you something great about this regiment. So I encourage you to definitely take a trip to New Britain to see the monument. And you can read an article about it that we published in Connecticut Explored magazine on our website at ctexplore.org that you can read for free. I'll put a link in the show notes for this episode to that article. I want to thank you, Talia, so much for being here and for telling us this important story. And I hope that listeners will be able to share photographs with us of people from their families that served in this regiment. Oh, and one more thing. What happened to the regiment after Korea?
So the regiment, like I was saying, the military started desegregation. And so the regiment was essentially ended and sent back to Puerto Rico as the Puerto Rican National Guard.
Well, and they've clearly had their hands full with things like hurricanes. So they're still on the ground working hard, to say the least. Thank you again so much, Talia. It's a great story. I recommend everyone get a copy of the book. Share it with your young adult readers. Share it with your veterans. It's a great story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Talia Aikens-Nunez is available for book talks and signings. She can be reached on her website at kidslitvitalia.com. Subscribe to get your copy of Connecticut Explored magazine delivered to your mailbox or your inbox. Subscribe at ctexplore.org. You won't want to miss our summer issue with new places to go. This episode of Grading the Nutmeg was produced by Mary Donahue and engineered by Patrick O'Sullivan at highwattagemedia.com. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode of Grading the Nutmeg, the podcast of Connecticut history.